The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Proudly sponsored by Volkswagen. Volkswagen.ie.
Thanks, Eileen. Thanks so much. Good afternoon on this Friday afternoon. 515 for your text. You can send us emails to ray@rte.ie. Dr. Michael Mosley will be joining us after 4 o'clock. We tried to get him earlier in the week, but we lost the line. So he guarantees he's going to be on a landline today. So we're speaking to him about his new book, The Fast 800. He's the man who created the 5-2 diet. And at the time, it was poo-pooed by a lot of people. And since he released the book, I think 5 or 6 years ago, the NHS in England are encouraging people to go on the 5-2 diet, just certain type of people. Anyway, he has the new book, The Fast 800, and we'll be talking to him about that after 4 o'clock. I'm sure he has opinions about the Lancet study, which is encouraging us all to cut down our red meat intake by 90% and our chicken intake and our fish intake and everything else intake. So we'll be talking to him about that as well. And in our soundtrack today, writer John Boyne, him of The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas, he's coming in to talk us through the soundtrack to his life, which I'm really looking forward to. And we have Lorraine from last night's First Dates. I don't know if you saw it. Lorraine from Limerick. She stole the show. Herself and Peter were on a first date on the telly last night, and we'll be talking to her about that very, very shortly. Yesterday, William got on to us and asked us to throw it out there, as they say, throw it out there and ask your listeners if they have any ideas for non-alcoholic related activities for a stag weekend, which we did. And loads of them came into 515-51, and I didn't get to them yesterday. So just very quickly then, we fly through these. Francis says, my husband is a pioneer, and for his stag, they went karting, quasar, they played snooker, and then they went for food. And this is the best bit of this. And then they dropped my husband home and went for a few drinks. I love that. So he wasn't included in the last bit of his own stag. I love that. Pamela here from the award-winning Hen and Stag Supplier of 2018, the Courtyard Apartments in Carrick and Shannon. We offer stays, loads of packages for stags, cube challenge, air rifle, archery, water sports, clay pigeon shooting, paintball, foot golf, to mention a few. So that's that award-winning Courtyard Apartments in Carrick and Shannon. That's a real stag and hen destination, isn't it? And then somebody else was on again. Coast steering. These are in Sligo. Coast steering, whitewater rafting, blindfolded driving. Is that safe to be encouraged? Maybe not. Surfing, clay shooting, fun balls, the Highland Games and more. And Big Days Out in Leitrim is a great option for stags, says somebody else. BigDayOutInLeitrim.com. And a great day at Mourne Shooting Grounds for a stag. Clay pigeon shooting. Don't need to be familiar with shooting as well. It'll be laid on by Sean Martin and team. So there you go. If you're planning a stag, William is. There's some non-alcoholic related activities. Tom was on this as well from Sweeney Todd Grooming Products. He says, I was listening to your show the other day when I heard you talking about Gillette and their new ad. Such a load of rubbish. We're talking about having a shave. What has that got to do with how you live your life, treat other people, etc.? Way beyond me, says Tom. Anyways, please find a closed sample of one of our products. Now, we don't want you to change, treat other people differently or whatever. You just have to have a shave and enjoy it. So that's Tom Cronin from Sweeney Todd. Thanks for that, Tom. But they're still talking about it, Tom. And I think for that reason, it has achieved its goal already. Jerry was on to us. He was listening in on Monday when we had journalist and author Carl Honoré on, about his new book called Bolder. It's about the fact that we're all going to live longer and how we should live our lives and ageism and other things. Jerry was on. He says, I was listening to your program on Monday afternoon, as is my wont. Thank you for that. I was taken by one of your guests who was holding forth on the facts of growing old. Some of his assumptions were very good, but most of them were the fictions of growing old. Not a mention of the body parts breaking down and being replaced. Hips, heart, liver, kidneys, lungs, knees, teeth, upper and lower, just to mention a few. Not a mention of rheumatism, being attacked by your heart, peepers not working, prostate not operating, having to check out how many toilets are on the route when you go for a mile-long walk, if you can get the legs to work, that is. Ray, I do believe your guest was 50 years old. There's absolutely no way he can imagine what it's like to reach one of the big, big O's. He's only a chiseler. In the Dublin sense of the word, not the American. A young fella, a chap, a gossoon. However, I wish him well in his endeavours. I myself and my friends Peter, Jerry and Eamon have reached one of the big, big O's. All right. We have a little experience in this area, which I think gives us bragging rights. When people ask us how old we are, we tell them we are 70 in the shade. Attached, please find a little poem I've written covering the subject. Hope you like it, Gerry Dignam. I did like it, Gerry. I can't read the whole thing out. I'll just give them a flavour of your poem. My libido's gone, had its swan song. My body's had enough. And leg over is well over when you can't get the up. That'll give you a taste of Gerry's poem about the ageing process. But you have a sense of humour about it, which is important. And this one came in about Operation Transformation. I downloaded the Operation Transformation app today, put in my stats, weight and height, and then big full stop. My BMI wasn't higher than 26 to qualify to view or visit the rest of the content. So I upped my weight by 2 stone. Can't believe only fat people are living and eating healthily or unhealthily. Not. It seems that Operation Transformation believe that because of my weight and height that I have the perfect body. Believe that I eat very healthily. Believe that I exercise and have a good level of fitness. Believe that my cholesterol is perfect. Wrong. I too need inspiration and motivation. Today, I got that motivation. I went for my 4-minute walk, 1-minute jog by 6. I made 3 recipes from the app. I feel I'm doing something good for me, even though I'm 2 stone heavier. That's on the app, of course. Please ask Operation Transformation to please let other thin people access the goodness that we can get from taking part. That's Mary there. And we put a call in and they said they've changed it. They've changed it. So there won't be a ceiling of a BMI of 26. Anybody can get involved on the Operation Transformation app. It's proven to be very popular this year. Over 400,000 people tuned in on Wednesday night to see the leaders have their second weigh in. They lost over 50 pounds between the 5 of them. And we're having all of them on tomorrow night in their shrunken states. So we'll be talking to Cahill and Pam and Siobhan and Jean and Paul on the TV show tomorrow night. We also have Noel Edmonds. Noel Edmonds. Now, back in the day, or still to this day, when people ask me, who are your heroes? Who inspired you? I always say Gay Byrne and Noel Edmonds. And I've met Gay Byrne, the pleasure of meeting Gay Byrne on a number of occasions. I've spoken to Noel Edmonds on the phone, but I've never met him. So I'm really looking forward to having him on the telly tomorrow night. And we'll talk to him about Swap Shop and Noel Edmonds' house party and Deal or No Deal and I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here and loads of other things. So that's on the telly tomorrow night. And Mick Flannery is there for music with his new song. Now, still on Operation Transformation, we got an email from a PRO of a GAA club. And when you get an email from a PRO, you have to take heed. I am the PRO, that's the Public Relations Officer, from St. Lawrence's GAA Club in County Kildare. You may know of it, I do. And we are lighting up our pitches twice weekly, Tuesdays and Thursdays, 7 to 9, for Operation Transformation 2019, utilising our dedicated 0.75-kilometre walking, jogging, running track around the GAA pitches. And we need your help. We have an outside speaker in which we stream music from Spotify each night for our Operation Transformation. We are using your Ray Darcy Show Operation Transformation playlist on Spotify. And I'm just wondering, would you be able to make another additional playlist, approximately 2 hours long, so as we can have some additional different songs for the Operation Transformation nights? We have a few weeks left of OT 2019 and we're hoping you will be able to help us on this one. Everybody in St. Lawrence's, and that came in from the PRO there, who is Jonathan. Jonathan, I did that today at my desk, so there's 2.5 hours now up on the same playlist and hopefully you enjoy it. And there's some new stuff and some old stuff, and you have to be aware that I would imagine on those lighting up events, and I think they were happening all over the country last night, that there's a number of generations. You're going to have, I'd say, 9 to 90 on those. So it's a difficult one. It's a difficult one. You're putting a playlist together to suit everybody. But I hope I have. I hope I've satisfied everybody. There's a couple of songs here that I've included. Anyway, they're old mainly. I'll get the three lads to pick one of them first today. So one of three songs, lads. This one. That's Laura Branigan and Gloria. This one. George Ezra, Paradise. That's a good stomping tune, isn't it? You can see people walking to that. Or this one. Elton John and I'm Still Standing. Will it be 1, 2 or 3? We're going 1, we're going 2 and we're going 2. 2 gets it. Sorry about that, Neil. Brian and Andrew are going for Paradise by George Ezra. 51551 or ray@rte.ie. Good afternoon. my love. My lover, 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 I'm in paradise whenever I'm with you. My mind,
my mind,
my mind, well, it's a paradise whenever I'm with you. Ride on, well, I will ride on down the road. I will find you, I will hold you, I'll be there. It's long, well, it's a mighty long road, but I'll find you, I will hold you, and I'll be there.
I know you heard it from those other boys, but this time it's real, it's something that I feel it. From those other boys, but this time it's real. It's something that I feel it. It feels like paradise running through your bloody veins. You know it's love heading your way. It feels like paradise running through your bloody veins. You know it's love heading your way.
My time. My time, well, it's a never-ending helter-skelter. We'll be out whatever the weather. My heart,
my heart,
my boom, boom heart. It's a beating, it's a thumping, and I'm alive.
I know you heard it from those other boys, but this time it's real. It's something that I feel it. I know you heard it from those other boys, but this time it's real. It's something that I feel.
Roll on, roll on, meet me there. Roll on, roll on, paradise. Roll on, roll on, meet me there. Roll on, roll on, paradise. Roll on, roll on, meet me there. Roll on, roll on, paradise. Roll on, roll on, meet me there. Roll on. George Ezra and Paradise on RT Radio 1. 5151 or RT.ie. A doctor told me before, you walk slower when listening to music, believe it or not, says Joe in Galway. I tried running with music, and despite what your doctor says, I found that I ran in time with the music, which makes sense. So that was fine when the music and the beats per minute, you know, mirrored your running. But when it was slower or faster, it upset me. So I stopped listening to music. I prefer to listen to the birds and listen to my own thoughts. Yeah, there's a world. So I think it has to mirror the pace that you're running or walking at. Why do they persist on operation transformation in using pounds and stones in relation to weight and not kilograms and grams? At the very least, for a transition period, they should use both unit types. I must ask them about that. I don't know the answer. I don't know the answer. Ardmore Adventures in Ardmore offer kayaking, canoeing, rock climbing, paddle boarding, rock climbing, all suitable for non-alcoholic stag parties. Coal steering is a thing. If you've never done it, it's a great thing. I particularly like it because I was brought up in Kildare, We're not near the sea. Even the fish didn't have to know how to swim in Kildare. So I didn't have that opportunity as a kid to jump off rocks into the sea or a river or a lake or whatever. So coast steering as an adult, you get into your wetsuit, you have your life jacket on and a helmet, and they bring you along the coastline, and then as you get higher and higher and jump off into the sea, and then you swim to the next bit of rock and you climb up and you get higher, and until the end you're, I don't know what height you're at, 10 metres high, and you're jumping into the sea. It's very exhilarating, coast steering. Very exhilarating. On Noel Edmonds, I'm looking forward to seeing Noel Edmonds on your show tomorrow night. Just wondering, do you have to give a list of questions to his PR or his agent before interviewing him? Just curious, as he has rippled the waters recently post I'm a Celebrity, and wonder if we will see the real Noel tomorrow. Well, we don't, Julie, is the answer to that. So I think he's very much an open book. So you will see the real Noel Edmonds tomorrow night on the show. Noel tried to buy the BBC with a syndicate a few years back. Watch yourself tomorrow night. He could be your new boss. He's a legend. Loved Deal or No Deal, says that person. And go on, please read the full poem out, Jerry Dignam's poem. We'll put it up. We might put it up on the online so you can read it. Now, just on a serious note, and you might have heard this or read it in the newspaper, but the radio centre here is reeling because we've lost a colleague, Alan McQuillan. He was only in his late 30s, and he died suddenly and tragically in Beaumont Hospital the other morning. And he was just one of those guys. He was a constant presence around the place. He was always happy and smiley and chatty. He was one of the good guys, so we'll miss him terribly. And our thoughts are with his family and friends. So Alan McQuillan, the late Alan McQuillan, rest in peace.
The Ray Darcy Show. Be at rte.ie. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Or ray at rte.ie. 51551 for text on this Friday afternoon. Now, last night on the telly, First Dates is back. And it was very entertaining last night. And the woman who stole the show was a Lorraine from Limerick. And she's on the line now from her home in Limerick. Hello, Lorraine.
Hi, Ray. How are you?
How are things?
Oh, jeez, like a whirlwind. I'm wrecked. Yeah. Wrecked.
Who did you watch the show with last night?
Oh, about 10 of my friends came over, all girls.
Right.
All girly worlies. Yeah, we did. It was a great night. And my brother and his friends did waiters, did ticket balls and all, and then we had a great crack.
Right. Oh, they did waiter for the night. Very good.
They did waiter for the night. They were shy, though.
You've set the tone. What did your friends think of your performance on First Dates?
Well, they know what I'm like. They actually do know what I'm like. But they thought I did Limerick proud. I came across very well, and it was me. It was me.
Yes. You weren't trying to be somebody else. You didn't put on your posh voice.
No.
You didn't put on your posh voice.
No, right? I wasn't doing a Mrs. Bouquet.
Hello. I'll have the duck, please.
You're Mrs. Bouquet.
I'll have the duck. Yeah. Peter was your date.
He was.
Yeah, and you said before that the type of man you were looking for was Orlando Bloom, Johnny Depp, or Dwayne Johnson. Now, they're sort of all very different. And then
yeah,
you got.
Right, they're characters now, Ray. Not them. It was like, you know, the Jack Sparrow and the Orlando. You know, Orlando was the Legolas in Lord of the Rings.
Yes.
And then top it all off with Dwayne Johnson. That's my smile.
And then you got Peter.
Yeah.
Lovely man.
No, really was. We had a great crack. We really did. We had a great laugh. My stomach was killing me the following day. Absolutely. I was in pain.
Yeah.
I'm laughing.
And now, did the wine actually go up your nostrils in that part of the day?
I know. Do you know what? This stage where I couldn't even tell you. I don't remember.
Right.
And I never spew wine. It's the one drink I wouldn't fall. I wouldn't actually leave fall or actually anything happen it. So I love my Dino.
Yeah. Tell us a bit about yourself. Do you mind? Can I ask your age?
You got a course. I'm 52 in July.
Right, 52 in July. Okay.
52 in July.
Yeah. How long have you been single?
Well, a couple of years now. Yeah.
Right.
That sounds terrible the way you said that. How long have you been single?
No, well, I'm just, for people who didn't see it, they wouldn't know your vital statistics.
A couple of years.
How did your friends react to the whole thing about you saying, am I a flirt? I don't know if I'm a flirt. And there you were with Matteo, the maitre d'.
I know. I didn't realise I even did that. I actually didn't realise I did that now. I really didn't. I suppose we all flirt in a way, don't we?
Yeah.
You're not flirting with yourself in the mirror, you're flirting with somebody you're talking to. Or, I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just natural. I don't know.
My favourite thing was at the end, and you, there was loads of bits. Like, you stole the poor man's dessert when he went to the loo.
I didn't steal. I was helping him out.
Oh, you were helping him out. Sorry.
I was helping him out. I'm a full-bodied woman. I needed energy and fuel.
And then it comes to that moment at the end where the two of you are side by side, and the producer, the researcher, whoever asks you. So we'll take it up from there. So this is you and Peter side by side, face onto the camera. You've had a lovely date. You've laughed out loud, belly laughs, and then the question.
So the million-dollar question:
are we going to see each other again? Are you stupid? No. But I love him to be.
Are you stupid?
I'm telling you, if you saw the rest of the footage when they did that interview, I swear to God. Do you know the expression, I wet myself? I actually literally wet myself.
So you went, yourself and Peter went off afterwards. You got into a taxi together.
We went for a drink. We went into town, had a drink together, met two of his friends, and my friend came along.
Yeah. Now, do you know the way they said as friends, and it was in inverted commas, and then they put that up at the end as well, as friends in inverted commas, which suggests to me that maybe something happened?
Well, no, I will say this now. We did have a bit of a snog.
Did you?
We did. But I thought, you know, just in case there could have been a tinkle, you know, somewhere. And no, Ray, there was no tinkle. Dinata.
Oh, all right. And did you ask him if he had a
little tinkle?
Did you ask him if he had a tinkle?
No, I didn't.
Right.
I shouldn't.
Okay.
Yeah, but see, his tinkle would probably be visible. Mine wouldn't be.
Right. We're back to the birds and the bees here. Did he text you afterwards last night, or what was his reaction?
No, but his friend that was with him, Sarah, actually this is very good, Sarah got a hold of me this morning, she texted me this morning through Messenger, and she said they're actually holding a fundraiser night to show the blind AIDS and everything else for Peter, and they're going to give all the funds that are raised to a charity.
Oh, very good idea.
That was very good. And she texted me and said, will you do something? I said, look, get him a dessert and tell him I sent it over.
Ah, very good.
And she started laughing. I said, if you want to get him to ring me, or I'll give him a buzz sign later on for the last and watch his face go pale, I'll do that, I said.
Great. He said he went into the loo in the middle of the date as you ate his dessert. And you, of course, wouldn't have known what he was saying to his mates. And he said, you're one of a kind. He said you were 100% full on and not what he expected. Which is all, that's all pretty positive, isn't it?
Oh, that was very good. That is me, though. That is me, Ray. I mean, there's no reason to deny that I am full on.
Now, here's the
and
thing.
I'm worse with a couple of drinks.
Here's a thing that has happened over the years on first dates. You're out there now. People know you. People tuned in. And sometimes in the past, viewers have contacted first daters and a relationship will start as a result of that.
Go away.
Yeah. Have you had any contact? No, since last night?
Are you late? No.
No, it could happen yet. It could happen yet.
Well, me and technology in my fingers, I probably deleted it.
Well, listen, you're great. You're full of life. You're full on. You're one of a kind. And you're very entertaining last night. And if people didn't see it, it's up there on the RTE player, the revamped, rebranded one. Lorraine from Limerick, thanks for taking our call. See ya.
Thanks, Ray. Bye.
Bye.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. RTE
at RTE.ie. Now sit back and relax, because for the next half hour or so we're in the company of writer John Boyne. Good afternoon, John. And John's going to guide us through the soundtrack to his life. Before we get to that, I know you were on with Brenda just after Christmas there. Congratulations on winning Celebrity Home of the Year.
Thank you very much. Yeah. I was surprised to both be a celebrity and to,
to win.
I don't know, maybe the home is the celebrity, I'm not sure. But it was a lot of fun.
Yeah. So you've only recently redone the interior of your house.
Yeah, it's kind of an ongoing project over the last 2 years. And I just kind of gutted it completely and moved walls. And the first thing I wanted was to get as much space for books as possible and to use unusual spaces for it. Like, you know, up in the attic and the eaves and above doors and so on. Places that often goes a waste, you know. But once I got into it, I got completely obsessed, you know, with colours and with interior design websites and all sorts of things, and, you know, having the right kettle and the right toaster. And
is that your personality? Are you a little bit obsessive about things?
I mean, I do get quite obsessive about things, that's for sure. I have a lot of lists, you know. Okay. I'm very list based person. But it was a lot of fun to do. And because I work from home, I want to make it as comfortable as possible and as interesting as possible. And I have a lot of little knickknacks and things and lots of stuff from my travels and things that remind me of places that I've been. And I know, it just makes me happy.
Yes. And it's nice, isn't it, to sit down at home and look around and home in on something and concentrate on that. And if that makes you happy, makes you smile, that's a good thing.
Yeah, yeah.
The things that I noticed, two things, right? Firstly was your collection of bookends.
Yes.
Yeah. Do you know anybody else whose collection of bookends?
I don't, but actually I've had lots of people on Twitter messaging me saying, where did you get all those bookends?
Yes. You know, so for example, you had one end of a sewing machine.
Yeah.
Yeah, you had a transistor split in two.
Yeah.
What else did you have? Do you have an arrow?
I've got like a spear. Like a spear. Dogs split in two, yeah. A spear.
Were they all bought as bookends, or did you get them made? Oh, they're all bought as bookends.
Yeah, and look, you get them from like vintage websites and things, and Etsy and places like that.
Right.
And you know, they're actually not that expensive. You know, it might be like, you know, 20, 30 quid or something. Yeah. And they're sort of works of art in themselves, like just beautiful things. And what I found was, rather than like putting a whole shelf of books, if you put like a little bookend, a few books, and then the other bookend, have a space and maybe put an ornament. So I'm turning into a total designer now. I should be one of the judges on the show.
Sure. And they were completely impressed by, you turn the landing and then you're up into the attic.
Yeah.
So you created this sort of nearly like an old library feel. So you had that ladder.
Yes. Well,
is there a name for that type of ladder?
I don't think so. Just a library ladder, I guess.
Yeah.
And I had been thinking about converting the attic, but the attic was too small to kind of stand up in. So then I thought, well, what if I just take out the wall at the front of it and, you know, shelve it up there and then put the ladder? And the risk of shameless name dropping, I was in Cecilia Ahern's house and she has a ladder.
Oh, does she? A library ladder. Oh,
she has a library ladder. So I wanted a library ladder.
Right.
And so I got the library ladder. And actually what it reminds me of is, you know, in My Fair Lady, Professor Higgins, when he's swinging around the library on his ladder.
Yes.
But it's just over my staircase. So I always think, I know how I'm going to die. You
know, that's how you're going to die.
Eventually I'll be shelving sort of Carl Ove Nosegard and I'll tumble down and that'll be the end of it. But they'll say, you know, he went the way he would have wanted to go.
So that's on, is it on wheels or something that it goes
around? Yeah, it's on at the top, it's on like a wheel. So you pull out the base,
yeah,
and then you can just roll it around.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Is there any coincidence that your current book is called A Ladder to the Sky?
Well, that is a coincidence.
Oh, is it a coincidence, right? Because you can say that's a ladder.
Nice segue.
Thank you very much. Yeah. I worked for hours
on
that.
You're not doing this. When I did a few photo shoots and stuff for when the book came out, for newspapers or whatever, I would sit on the ladder. And we would do that.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's very clever.
Right. Well, congratulations.
Until I got a bit tired.
So are people knocking in now wanting to sit in your, you know, are you getting more visitors?
People keep coming up to me in Tesco's and things.
Do they?
Can I move in with you?
Yeah. Right, you're here for Soundtrack to Your Life.
Yes.
So let's get started then. You were born in St. Michael's in Leary in 1971. Helen's your mum, Sean's your dad.
That's right.
Both of them still alive.
They are indeed.
Right. And where are you in the family?
I'm the third of four. There's my older sister, my older brother, then me, and then my younger sister who's sitting out there.
And this is her first time in RTE?
It's her first time in RTE. She wanted to come here because she'd always had a crush on you, right? She had posters of you on her bedroom wall.
Oh, no.
And so I took her out here to see
you. Did you? Right. Okay. Right. That's great. I'll give her the full tour afterwards. I'll bring her over and show her the Late Late studio if she wants. That's Sinead outside, yeah. Okay, so what did your parents do?
My dad was an insurance broker and my mum a housewife.
Right, and he grew up on Boyne Street.
Yes, he did. I'm sure many of your listeners will know Boyne Street, just off Pierce Street in the centre of Dublin. And he grew up there, like in those days now, with him and his parents, his grandparents and so on, they were kind of tenement houses really back in the start of the, you know, the 20s, 30s, the 40s. But there was, as there often was with those kind of houses in Dublin at the time, there was like four, five, six houses in a row which were all occupied by the same families. You know, sort of like your aunts would be in one house, your grandparents in another, the children kind of spread between. So I think my dad was one of about 11 or 12. But it was only a two-bedroom little house, you know.
Yeah.
So I think the kids would be spread out between different members of the family and so on. But the street itself is called Boyne Street. And I think that then goes back to just generations past, that they'd lived there for 150 years.
So it's named after your family?
Yes.
That's sort of nice, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
I'm hoping that where I live will be John Boyne Road.
John Boyne Road. And it'll have a plaque, winner of Celebrity Home of the Year 2019.
That's what I'll be remembered for.
And your mum, where was she from?
Artane.
All right, so dub.
Yeah, actually quite unusual in that way, because I think all four of my grandparents were all Dubs as well, which I think is unusual. Usually, you know, you'll have somebody coming in from...
From the country,
from yes, rural areas.
Yeah, yeah. So what's your first memory then? It doesn't have to be an audio one. What's your first living memory?
My first memory, I think, is I was in hospital to get my tonsils out, and there was this weird... This is going to sound very strange, but apparently it's true. When I was a kid, I was about 3 years old, and my brother was about six. And back in those days, it was thought that you should get your tonsils out, even if there was nothing wrong with them, right? But my brother needed his tonsils out. So the Dublin hospitals were doing a 2-for-1.
Ah, go on.
I'm serious. This is true. They were doing a 2-for-1 deal that if a sibling had to have them out, then you could bring another one in and they could go undergo, like, you know,
major surgery.
Yeah. Major surgery for no apparent reason. So Paul had to have his out and I was dragged in to have mine out. And I just sort of remember being in the room and ringing, you know, there was like the little bell over the bed where you'd ring for the nurse, and then the nurse coming in and just like eating the face off me for ringing the bell. I think that's my first memory.
Sure,
I couldn't even speak, you know, because my tonsils had been...
And then they were feeding jelly and ice cream and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, that would have been good though.
Yeah. And what about... It's nearly like a psychiatrist question, but what's your first memory of you as a person? Sort of coming into the world and knowing that you were different and that these things sort of made you John Boyne as opposed to somebody else.
I would say it was probably something like the library down in Dundrum, the Carnegie Library, which is still there. And I remember always feeling kind of safer in that kind of silence and that kind of peace than I did in a classroom, really. That I was a nervous kid, you know, I wasn't very, I didn't have very much confidence, really. And I liked being in that like little peaceful area, and I felt safe and secure there.
So were you a loner?
Yeah, I think I probably was. You know, it wasn't that I didn't have any friends or anything, but I would have had a couple of close friends, and I would have left it at that. You know, that was enough for me. I wasn't somebody who would have been kind of leading a group or anything like that. I was just shy. Mm. You know, little nerd.
And you were brought up in Sandyford at the time. That was at the fringe, on the fringes, at the outskirts. There was nothing past Sandyford, really, much.
Not much past it, but, you know, my next door neighbour on one side was the parish priest, and on the other side was 9 nuns.
Right.
So I grew up in this little, the meat and that sandwich. I was an altar boy and all
that. Was that the parochial house there in Sandyford?
They just bought, like, the parish priest of Sandyford still lives in that house. It's just like a regular... regular home. And they had bought it. I think at the church there are two little parochial houses, but the parish priest lived in the house next door to my parents.
So because it was all fields beyond you, wasn't it?
Yeah. I think once you went up past... past Sandyford Village, that was about as far as it went. I remember there was a little post office at the very top of Sandyford Village. And I think after that, it was be dragons.
The first thing is straight into music, really. But we'll play this and you can talk to me about it afterwards. So the theme from Top of the Pops.
Oh, yeah.
Thursday nights, wasn't it? Thursday nights.
Yeah, I mean, you would have grown up with this as well. It was like the most important. Because, you know, when we were kids, the charts meant so much. I don't know if they mean that much to kids anymore, if people even know what number one is. But it was such a big deal back then. And I remember I used to be just like glued to Top of the Pops every Thursday night. Who's going to be on it? What's going to be number one? What's up? What's down? What's the new entries? And I was a total music obsessive as a kid. I was as much into music as I was into books, I'd say. And I probably knew more about music. You know, you could probably pick any song from the, you know, the 80s, and I'd know exactly what number it got to in the chart.
Would you? Well,
yeah.
Well, that sort of level.
Yeah. Well, myself and my friend Stephen used to, who lived around the corner from me, and we used to get like, you know, you remember like the double tape decks?
Yeah.
And then we would do, you remember that song 19? No. And we used to get
Paul Hardcastle,
that's it. And we used to tape songs like from the top 40 when it would be on, like the Larry Gogan one on the Sunday, whatever. And then we would do all the, We would turn every song into that.
Oh, no, right. Like, okay, yeah.
We thought we were right little DJs.
Oh, that was quite creative.
It was quite creative.
Yeah, quite creative. And was there ever a chance that you would have went that road, the musical road, as opposed to the writing road?
I don't think so. I mean, I played piano. My dad always brought us to piano lessons, and I played guitar. And, I'd sing a little bit when I do that. So, but I don't think I'd have the talent, yeah. Really.
So as getting older then, fifth, sixth, going into the first year, you're definitely finding your place in the world. Mm-hmm. Secondary school then, what was that like for you?
Well, it wasn't great.
Wasn't it? No.
I went to Terenure College, and I guess I wasn't really Terenure material in a way.
Why not?
Well, I wasn't sporty, for one thing. You know, I wasn't interested in rugby. And back in those days, it was very much... I mean, it's almost a cliche now, but that sort of thing of like the rugby guys were the only ones that mattered, and everybody else could be, you know, just left behind. It didn't really matter to them, and it was strange rules and things. I think back then, I was talking to somebody from my class recently, where we were saying that, you know, after first year, they would add up the points of everybody that everything you got from your exams in first year, and then you would be split into five groups for the next 3 years, from the smartest...
Streaming, yeah.
But it would mean that, like, you know, at the age of 14, you were told, guess what, you're one of the thickest. And
that's it. And unfortunately, and then it's a self-fulfilling prophecy then.
Yeah, yeah. And I remember, like, you know, then it would make... You know, you'd go past the lowest class and you think, God, you know, if I go in there, you know, I'll be eaten alive or something. But the kids wouldn't... The teachers wouldn't be teaching them. And I always think, why didn't they do it every fifth person so that...
Yes, you know, mix them up,
and yeah. That so everybody could learn from each other and help each other. It was a very strange system. So I didn't really enjoy school very much. I was pretty glad when it was over.
And did you find then solitude or whatever? What's the word I'm looking for? In a library, not solitude.
Yeah,
but
I found it. I guess in both in reading and writing, because I'd started writing when I was about 14. I would say started writing stories myself, and. You know, when I get home from school, you know, I do my homework, but the next thing I wanted to do was just sit and write stories. So it was never really something that I said to myself, what will I do? Oh, I think I'll be a writer. You know, it was always
going to be.
Yeah, in the same way that, like you were saying about the music, that if I had been more inclined in that way, I would have just finished my homework and wanted to just sit at the guitar or something.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to be with, you know, paper and pen and write.
And what were you reading?
I was reading a lot, around the age of 13, 14, I started reading a lot of the kind of old classic literature. I read a lot of the Dickens orphan books, David Copperfield, Oliver Twist, Nicholas Nickleby, those things. And kind of old adventure novels, things like Treasure Island, Robinson Crusoe, the Three Musketeers. Those kind of books don't get written so much anymore. But I also remember around the same time, do you remember there was... it was called like the Great Writers, Marshall Cavendish Collection, right?
No.
So, well, what it was was...
it was one of those things advertised on the telly.
Yeah, where you pay like 99 pence for the first one, and then every next one is a little bit good or something. And my dad bought it, and every 2 weeks, like a new hardback novel would come, and it would be like Pride and Prejudice or Jane Eyre, Vanity Fair, something like that. And that was my first experience of reading all of those. But as well as the stories, as well as the writing, I've always loved that physical object, and they produced them really beautifully.
Well, yes, yeah.
And you could line them up on the shelf, and they would look really, really well. I think a lot of them are still in my parents' house, actually.
And the smell of a new book.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like the smell of a school bag.
Yeah, you know, So then as a teenager, you were sort of struggling with your sexuality.
I mean, everybody does when they're a teenager trying to figure it out.
Yes.
And but for me, of course, because I was realizing I was gay, yeah, then that makes it a little bit more difficult, especially in the mid-80s, where, firstly... You know, you'd be going home from school and listening to the radio, and there was the AIDS crisis had really hit, and you're thinking, "Oh Christ, this is what the future holds now." And also, then in school, you know, you'd have the priest telling you how appalling that was and
unnatural.
Yeah, and you know, we could go down that road, and we know what happens. And so, you know, when you are being belittled and when you are being made less of, I think when you're a child, it's not going to do an awful lot for you.
No. So how do you get around that then? How do you rationalise in your own head?
I mean, there's nothing you can do about it. So you just have to kind of, you eventually just come to terms with it and find somebody to tell and find somebody to kiss. And, you know,
who'd you tell and who'd you kiss?
I mean, I told my family pretty early on, around the age of 20, 21, I think.
Right.
And there was no real drama.
But you knew long before that.
I knew when I was about 8.
Did you?
Yeah. I remember, I can tell you exactly when I did.
Go on, yeah.
I was watching The Kids from Fame, which was, you know, my favourite show. And Danny Amatula, who I still remember his name. This is crazy. And I remember just watching Danny Amatula in Fame at the age of about 8 and going,
I fancy
him. Hello, Danny Amatula. And what happened to Danny Amatula?
I have no idea. And then this man.
Oh, Lord. Yes.
And there's a picture of himself, Morton Harkett.
Ray has just handed me a beautiful colour photo of Morton in a sleeveless T-shirt, which I will be taking home tonight. Yeah, I remember, like, A-ha was a bit of a turning point because I was 14 when that song, Take On Me, came out. And you know, A-ha came out with, like, the ripped jeans and the little thongs around the arms like he has there, and the hair and everything, and the Norwegian beauty.
Good looks, yeah.
But I remember what I did was, lots of people in my class loved A-ha, and I absolutely adored A-ha, but I told everybody I hated them. I was so terrified of my obsession with Morton in particular, that I just went around telling everybody that they were the worst band ever. And anybody I saw with, like, an A-ha record or, you know, A-ha scribbled onto their copybook or something, I would descend on them. You know?
Isn't that interesting?
It was the only time, I think it was the only time I ever bullied anybody. It was, you know, for people who were A-ha fans. It was crazy.
Because you were fearful it would reveal how you felt.
Yeah, I thought if anybody actually gets me started on Morton, I'm ruined. And so I thought I hope I don't sound like a complete idiot.
No, that's really interesting. That is
it was just a way, I think, of, you know, overcompensating.
Yes,
that's
yeah.
You know, where,
listen, I don't know, we just thought we'd do a little thing for you. They're in the Three Arena at the end of October. And we got on to our friends in MCD. No, it's not. It's Aiken Promotions. God, they'll kill me. Aiken Promotions. And they'd love to invite you along to see
A-ha. My God, you're kidding.
No, there you go. There you go. We don't know if there's a meet and greet. We'll have to talk to you about that. You can go along.
Fantastic.
And bring a friend. So that's 29th of October. And I think they're in Belfast on the 30th of October, if that suits better. But
that's brilliant.
They're in the Three Arena in Dublin. So that's nice, isn't it?
That's very nice.
That's nice. Them Aiken Promotions. Thank you very much. Now, this one.
High on a hill was a lonely goatherd, lay, oddlay, oddlay, loud was the voice of the lonely goatherd, lay, oddlay, oddlay.
Julie Andrews from The Sound of Music.
Yes. Well, what I remember of this was, every Sunday when I was a kid, we used to go over to my grandparents' house in Artane. And my granddad had this album. And again, I was much younger then, I was about, say, 8 or 9. And I used to listen to that record religiously. And I loved The Sound of Music. I was obsessed with it. And years later, in fact, I think, when I came to write Boy in the Striped Pyjamas, one of the characters in it, Lieutenant Kotler, the young Nazi lieutenant, yeah. I sort of based him a little bit on Rolf.
Yes.
You know, yeah. 16 going on 17.
Yeah,
guy.
Yeah.
But I just loved that. I just loved that movie. Even now when it's on, you know, I just was obsessed with it, but I, you know, I knew every word of it off by heart. I would just run into my grandparents' house, sit there, put on the record, and
the only sad thing, they're probably going to remake it now because they're doing it. They did it with Annie, and they did it with Mary Poppins, and they're doing it with something.
I could
else.
Play Captain Von Trapp.
Could you?
Yeah, I got a little whistle.
Yes. Yeah. We're talking to John Boyne, and he's talking us through the soundtrack to his life, and we'll talk to him more after a quick break.
The Ray Darcy Show.
John Boyne is with us, talking us through the soundtrack to his life. So, news events that would have made an impression on you.
One, I think, was in 1989 when I left school. That was the year that the Berlin Wall came down. And I got really interested in that, and it sort of triggered my interest in history very much. And, you know, as people would know, a lot of my books have been based around history and around Germany, often around the war and so on. So I got very interested in that. And even the most recent book has a whole section of it devoted to the fall of the Berlin Wall. Holocaust, things like that. You know, these are the things that I just got very, the non-fiction. I've never been a big non-fiction reader, I got to say. But that side of things, I did get very interested in. I think it triggered with that.
Okay. This is a report from Maggie O'Kane. And it was, what year was it there? I have it. 1989. I better get the exact detail. The 9th of November, 1989. So after 28 years, East Berliners are now free to travel across the border. And Maggie O'Kane was on the spot.
It's almost 3 o'clock in the morning here at Checkpoint Charlie. Hundreds of East Germans have come over in the last 4 hours. Many are now starting to return. The ones that I've talked to have come to look. They say they've never seen West Berlin and this is their first chance. Most are going back.
I was a man, 21, and I see people is jumping from the eastern side to the western side, and they were killed in this time. And now changes, they come to us without danger and free.
I'm happy. I have been dreaming of this for years, and I don't know what to say. I'm happy.
This is something, and I don't have even the English words to explain how I feel.
Bravo! There you go. Maggie O'Kane's report.
It wasn't long after that that the whole USSR thing happened, that the USSR fell apart, and, you know, Gorbachev and all that, and so it was, you know, all that stuff in Eastern Europe. I remember going to Prague around that time, about a year or two after the Velvet Revolution, and everything was so cheap. I remember, I think it was a year after my leaving cert or something, I went with a few friends, and we couldn't get over it. You know, yeah. Like you could buy dinners and pints for pennies.
Why did you not read nonfiction?
I don't know. I think I've just always wanted to lose myself in stories more than anything else. With novels and with movies, just I like my imagination more. One of my New Year's resolutions every year is to try to read more nonfiction, and I just never seem to drag myself to it. I don't know why.
Yeah. So you went to Trinity College, and then from there, where did you go to do postgrad?
I went to University of East Anglia in Norwich to do the MA in Creative Writing, and Malcolm Bradbury was teaching there. We were his last group. And that course had been running at that time since 71, so about 23 years, and produced lots of people. Ian McEwan was on the course, Ishiguro, Anne Enright, Glenn Patterson, Deirdre Madden, and subsequently people like Paul Murray went there and so on. So it's had a great reputation over the years. So I went there to have an environment, basically, in which to write. I think sometimes creative writing courses can get a bad reputation in a way where people think that they teach you how to write, or that they bring the same, they produce the same kind of writer. But it's just not the case. It's about providing a safe place for writers to be, to work throughout the year, to give each other work. And you learn so much more, I think, from reading other people's work and being prepared for class, you know, being able to talk about it, than you do from them talking about yours.
So you go off and write, and then the rest of the class critique what you've written?
Yeah, every sort of 3 weeks you would have, like, there'd be workshops each week, and it would be your turn sort of every third week. So you'd submit your work a week before, everybody would read it, and then you'd sit around and you couldn't talk. You know, you had to just sit and listen.
Take it.
And I've done the same
thing. Take like a man.
Yeah. And I've done the same thing when I've taught over the years, is that the person whose work is being discussed has to keep their mouth shut. Because, you know, if you get a novel, there's no point saying, oh, well, that's not what I meant.
Yes.
Or, yeah, you know, yeah. You're not going to be there when the reader's reading it. So
that's a fair point, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I was very young. I was only 22. But so it was a very emotional experience in a way. It was my first time away from home like that. And it was very intense, but very productive.
And you're still connected in that you fund a scholarship for it.
I do, yeah. I mean, I've had a lot of connections with them over the years. I've taught there a couple of times. And a few years ago, I set up a scholarship for Irish students who do that course. Because, again, when I was a student there, I was flat broke. Now, granted, you know, I was too lazy to get a job, so no one's paying for myself. But and what I did have, I was spending on beer. So, but anyway, so I set up this scholarship to pay the fees and for an Irish student each year, because we have such a history of Irish students doing that course. And people don't apply to me. What they do is they apply to get on the course. And then when the course is filled each year, anybody who's Irish is then eligible for the scholarship. There's loads of scholarships on the course. Like, there'll be a scholarship for, you know, Asian students, for over 40s, yeah, right, whatever. Yeah, yeah. They're trying to get every place basically funded one way or the other. So then anybody who's eligible gets put forward for this, and then one of them gets it.
Who are your heroes when it comes to writing?
John Irving. Right. Has been my hero since my teenage years.
And you're friends now?
I've become great friends with John. When I published my first novel almost 20 years ago, I sent John a copy of the novel with a letter. It was like the only fan letter basically I ever wrote, and sent him a letter saying how much he'd influenced me. And he read the book and he got back to me. And since then we struck up a friendship, and we'd see each other many times, and I've interviewed him on stages and he's interviewed me at the Toronto Festival. And he's just been a great mentor to me. Somebody I still feel starstruck around him. You know, I still feel like if I'm out for dinner with him, just thinking, bloody hell, that's John Irving.
The world the car into car. Hotel
yeah,
New Hampshire.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's still, I mean, you know, he was a wrestler and everything.
Yeah.
You know, he's now in his 70s and he's fitter than I am.
I interviewed him a couple of years ago and he arrived in a tracksuit. Like, he's
yeah, he works out every day.
Oh, does he? Right.
And when he does book tours, one of his main things is he won't do anything like between 4 and 6 because that's
in the gym.
Yeah. I think last time he was coming here, I guess when you interviewed him, he had emailed me to say, you know, what hotel should I stay in for the best gym? You know, so he's very, you know, it'd be great to have that kind of
discipline.
Discipline, indeed.
Right. And you're a big fan of this lady.
I know you have
yes.
life in you yet. I know you have a lot of strength left. I should be crying, but I just can't let it show. I should be hoping, but I can't stop thinking.
She's a genius.
She's the best. And
are you friends
I
with
would
her?
Say, unfortunately, I'm not. I have tried and tried and tried, but I just can't get through. David, you know David Mitchell, right? The
yes.
writer, and he wrote a piece in The Guardian, you know, one of those kind of My Hero pieces. And the day it was published, then Kate Bush phoned him and thanked him for it. And I'm sick about it because I'm friends with David and he always holds it over my head. But I've loved Kate Bush since I was a kid. I'm obsessed. I've got two tattoos.
Right.
This is better for TV than radio. But I've got one on my right arm, which says Wave After Wave,
which is
from Hands of Love. And on the back of the Hands of Love album, there's a quote from Morte Arthur by Tennyson, which feeds into the ninth wave section of that album. Wave After Wave, each mightier than the last. And on my left arm, I've got We Are All Terminal Cases, which is the last line of
The World According to
Garp. The World According to Garp. In The World According to Garp.
Now, I wouldn't have known that if I didn't read it in the brief, John.
So I like I've got my favourite singer, my favourite writer.
Yeah.
But they've both really influenced me. I'm with Kate Bush. I've been listening to those albums now my entire life and I never get bored of them. And I always find something new in them. And then I went to see, do you remember, it must be 3 or 4 years ago.
She was here, yeah.
When she did the concert in London. And myself and again,
but she's not here, no, just on.
No, she just did it at Hammersmith.
Yeah.
And we went to see it and we were in the second row and I remember when she came out and it was like a mythological person. I couldn't really believe she existed.
Right.
And it was so, because you know, she's not a recluse, but she's just private.
Yeah.
And
one of these days, John, if I remember talking to her, which I never will be, I'll say that would you give John Boyne a call for God's sake?
Please, yes.
I just read Ladder to the Sky, best book I've read in ages, loved it. It's a Susie.
That's thank
nice.
You.
And myself, age 7, and my sister, age 4, got our tonsils out at the same time, 2-for-1 deal in the 60s.
Yeah, see?
And John is right about the tonsils. I'm a similar age, and I was packed off to hospital to get my tonsils out with my sister when she needed to get hers out. I had no problem with my tonsils, but the doctor said she might as well get it done now, and they can be for each other in the hospital. I was 3 and she was 4. How things have changed, says Carol. And
what if something had happened to the healthy party?
Yeah, I know, it's ridiculous. Thanks to John for a fabulous interview. And I'm curious about John's surname. You don't hear many people with that name. Is there any historical story with a link to the name of the river? Ellen asks.
I don't know of one particularly, but I've never done that sort of genealogy thing, which I've always thought would be interesting to do.
Be careful now. You know those Ancestry.com?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because people are finding out that they're not who they think they are.
Oh.
So just be careful.
I wonder who I am.
There's a book we're having on in a few weeks, a lady called Shapiro, and she got a gift of an Ancestry.com thing and she found out that her dad, who she thought was her biological dad, wasn't in fact her biological dad.
Okay.
And she had a sister that she didn't know. So anyway, no, I'm sure everything's fine.
No, I would actually like to maybe do something like that at some point and find out a little bit more about the background.
Yeah.
Especially even just talking earlier there about Boyd Street and everything. It would be kind of interesting.
Well, who do you think you are?
I think you are.
Would you do it?
Now that I've done Celebrity Home of the Year.
Yes.
No, I want to do the dancing one.
Right, that's what the stars. Okay, I have all the numbers. I'll give them to you after the show. I really enjoyed our chat, John Boyd.
Right,
thanks very much. And enjoy the AHA concert.
I will. Thank you for that.
And thanks again to everybody at Aiken there for organising that. That's John Boyne there. We'll have another soundtrack to your life next week. Right now, Anish Toshi and Aoun de Free Skelton and Nocta, Lamora de Wallace. Looking forward to that. Thanks, Greg. And good morning, DeWallish. 5155 on ray@rte.ie. Somebody says, no lemons, Ray. You're a brave man. He's a tough interview. I don't think he is. I don't think he is. I'm really looking forward to it. I think he's very charming, very entertaining. No lemons on the telly tomorrow night after the news. Now, right now on the radio, We have Dr. Michael Mosley. Good afternoon, Michael.
Good afternoon. Hi there.
Thanks for taking our call. The Fast 800 is your new book. And for people who don't know, you are the man. Would you say co-created or co-invented the 5-2 fast diet?
Yeah, I mean, basically, I invented it on the back of a Horizon I was doing. But I got lots of help and advice from scientists on the way.
Yeah. And as I was saying to you the other day before we lost you, it was poo-pooed a lot of the time, but people have come round.
They have, yeah. So even the Department of Health, the NHS, who described it as a fad diet, now said it can be more effective than standard steady dieting, and it seems to have a bigger effect on things like your insulin level, which is kind of important if you're a pre-diabetic, diabetic, but frankly, if you're overweight as well.
Yeah.
So they're quite enthusiastic now.
I suppose with the Fast 800, people will say who are listening, 800 calories a day. What's the recommended intake for a man and a woman of calories a day?
Well, it depends on whether you're trying to lose weight or not.
Yes.
It's around 2,000 calories, and the general, you know, diets are somewhere in the range of 1,400 to 1,500 calories. And that, the idea there is you'll lose weight slowly and steadily. But we know from numerous studies that actually people really stick to it, the slow and steady route. They find it very unrewarding. And in numerous trials, huge numbers drop out.
Yeah.
So
it's not
the reason I've written this new book called The Fast 800 is because it's all about 800 calories, but also because there have been a number of big studies, I mean really big studies, which came out in the last year or so, showing it's much more effective doing rapid weight loss than the slow and steady route.
Because motivation is a huge factor, isn't it, in dieting?
100%.
Yeah.
And the other thing that happens is that, surprisingly enough, when you do this 800-calorie approach, it's about eating the right calories. There were rapid weight loss diets back in the 70s and 80s, and they went rather disastrously wrong because they were very poor quality ingredients in the shakes and things like that. So the world has moved on. We have much better quality shakes and also much better quality food, and an understanding of the amount of protein and stuff like that you need to eat.
Okay.
And the Fast 800 is actually a kind of graded program, because what I suggest you do is you start on the rapid 800 calories a day every day for a couple of weeks and see how that goes. And you should probably lose 3 to 4 kilos, maybe more in that time. And then you could kind of switch over to a 5-2 approach. And that's where you just have the 800 calories 2 days a week. And originally I suggested people eat 600 calories a day, but actually there have been a lot of studies since I wrote the original book which shows that people kind of find 800 more doable and they get the same benefits.
Mm. Now, you wouldn't ask anybody to do something that you wouldn't do yourself, so you...
Yep.
Put on weight.
I did.
Yeah. You let yourself go, as they say.
I let myself go, indeed. So the original reason I got into all of this was because 7 years ago in 2012, I discovered I was a type 2 diabetic, which was a nasty shock. And I persuaded the science series Horizon for the BBC to let me make a documentary in which I'd see if I could reverse it, cure myself without medication. And
yeah.
As part of that, I discovered intermittent fasting. I discovered the 5-2 diet. I lost about 10 kilos. My blood sugars returned to normal, where they've stayed ever since. In fact, I just pricked my finger just before I was speaking to you, just to check, because I like to check these things. I'm pleased to say my blood sugars are completely normal.
Do you check
so
daily?
It was the rapid weight loss that seemed to be the thing that did the deed,
if
you like.
Yeah.
I decided this summer, when I was writing the book, because I always test things, and this is a kind of reworked version. So I put on about 10 kilos, and my blood sugars went back into diabetes range. I started to snore like crazy, which my wife found very annoying. And I also developed huge cravings for food. So I put myself on this diet, and I shed it all in just under a month. Just under 4 weeks, about 3.5 weeks.
And was that interesting from the point of view of, like, you would be now a lot more aware of how you felt as you were, and now with a bit of weight on. So
absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think the other key thing, which is interesting, which I write about in the book, is that we are designed to run on two fuel systems. We evolved for a period of feast and famine. And so we're a bit like a hybrid car, which can flick from electric to gas when it runs out of electricity.
Okay.
And we normally run on sugar. That's kind of the preferred fuel. It's like the money in your pocket. But it's only when the sugar starts to run a bit low that we switch into fat burning.
Yes.
So most of us never do that, because we don't go 12 hours without food, which is when you flip the metabolic switch. And that's when, as I said, when you flip over into fat burning, which is kind of what you want to do, and then it starts to, after that, the fat burning really takes off. You can kind of bring it forward a bit by exercising as well. But if you've never experienced it, it's quite tough. It's like you run a marathon, and marathon runners describe hitting the wall. And that is the moment when their bodies switch from burning sugar to burning fat. And unless you're used to it, it's going to be a bit odd. So that's kind of, for me, I'm quite used to it because I've done fasting before.
Yes. And
but other people might find it a little bit of a shock. But as I said, it normally takes 2 or 3 days. Sorry. And it's also a super healthy thing because really you want to be fat burning. We have this idea, you know, if you don't eat for a half a day or so, you're going to run out of fuel. Actually, you have enough fat, enough fuel on you to keep you going for 6 months without any food. It's just we don't access it. The switch is so rusty, and that's part of what the book is about. How do you switch on the fat burning?
I wonder, would our ancestors have regularly gone into that state where they'd be feeding off their fat as opposed to running on sugar?
100%. I mean, they've studied this group called the Hadza, who are hunter-gatherers in Kenya, and who are the closest we have now, sorry, Tanzania, and who are the closest we have now to kind of what our ancestors would have been like. And that's what they do. They kind of have periods where they've got plenty of food, periods when they don't. They practice intermittent fasting naturally, and they also eat a load of fiber. So we've been hearing about why fiber is so good for you, and that's why also the recipes in my book are all based on what I would describe as a Mediterranean diet.
Yes.
Which gives you fiber, and it's good for your gut bacteria and stuff like that. But 100%, our ancestors would have feasted occasionally and had long periods without food. And they had to have a mechanism which would allow them to flip between burning sugar and burning fat.
Yeah. So in your book, The Fast 800, you talk about intermittent fasting. So even for people who don't need to lose weight, you're suggesting that it's a good thing to do?
Well, I'm more ambivalent about it because there haven't been that many studies.
Okay.
The thing I can say is that there are a load of scientists who I've spoken to because ever since I wrote the original book, I've kept in contact with all the people who research this stuff. And indeed, the book itself stirred so much interest that a whole lot of new studies got underway and got published in Australia, the States, and things like that. And both of them are done with people who are overweight, obese, type 2 diabetic, pre-diabetic. There's a kind of reason why you'd want to do the trial on them. So no one has done a trial on slim people because they're not a priority. They don't have a problem. Only if they're kind of slim but have pre-diabetes would you bother.
Okay.
So the honest truth is I don't know. All I can tell you is that an awful lot of the researchers are slim and an awful lot of them practice intermittent fasting in one form or another.
So that's,
I mean, one of the
anecdotal,
other popular forms which I write about in the book is called time-restricted eating, where you just eat your calories within a narrower time window. So you try and eat your calories within, say, 12 hours or 10 hours. So you'd stop eating, say, at 8 o'clock at night, and you wouldn't start again until 8 o'clock the next morning. And there's a raft of science showing the benefits of that. Plus, it actually makes doing the rapid weight loss part of the diet easier.
That's very doable, isn't it?
Very doable.
Very doable.
And it's become super trendy, particularly in the States. But we're not. It's based on the work of a guy called Sachin Panda, who's a prof over in California who I know well. And he did originally with animals. But over the last 6 years, human trials started happening. In fact, I do a series called Trust Me, I'm a Doctor for the BBC. We did the first ever human trial of this method about 2 years ago, and it was just published recently in a scientific journal. So I've been at the cutting edge of this for a while now, and I'm delighted to see it all coming together.
Talk to us about Dr. Roy Taylor, because we had a lady on the telly last week, Dr. Eva Horsmond, and she has published a book called How to Reverse Diabetes.
Yep.
And Dr. Roy Taylor has been doing that for quite some time. Do you say reverse or putting it into remission?
Okay, it's kind of a technical issue, I suppose.
Okay.
I wrote a book also called The 8-Week Blood Sugar Diet, which was published a couple of years ago and is still up there on Amazon. I wrote that with Roy Taylor because I've been collaborating with Roy Taylor for 4 years now. So I'm a huge fan of his.
Mm.
And what he showed way back when I first met him, but in small numbers, that you can lose about 10% of your body weight, maybe around 10 kilos, then the majority of people with type 2 diabetes can put it into remission. That's what I did. Now, remission just simply means it could come back if you were to put all the weight on. And that's what I demonstrated this summer. I put the weight on, my blood sugars went back again. The reason you get type 2 diabetes is because you're getting fat in your liver and your pancreas. You clog them up. They don't work so well. And after a while, they stop working altogether. But the great news is even when that happens, you can reverse it. Rapid weight loss diet will drain the fat out of your liver and pancreas. And Roy Taylor did a big study, which was published in January 2018, 300 people, and he showed that people doing this rapid weight loss, the 800-calorie diet, around half of them were able to, they lost an average of 10 kilos sustained for a year, and around half of them were able to reverse their diabetes.
Yeah.
Compared to the control group who were doing the standard slow and steady dieting, they lost an average of 1 kilo and none of them reversed their diabetes.
The UK government is
about to do a bigger trial, 5,000 people doing the 800-calorie approach, which is kind of in my book.
Right.
So absolutely, the evidence is unbelievably strong now, and the sooner you get on with it, the better. But there's another big study, 6 countries, people who have pre-diabetes. And in Ireland, about 1 in 3 of the population, adults, have pre-diabetes, which means you've got raised blood sugar levels, but they're not yet diabetic.
Yeah.
But you have, if you have raised, if you have pre-diabetes, that is bad. But the good news is you can do something about it. The bad news is you almost certainly don't know you've got it because there are no symptoms. It's only when you go for a screening, test your blood sugars, or start to develop diabetes that you notice.
And Michael, if you were going for your regular bloods, would they spot it?
They should.
Yeah,
I mean, they should
okay.
do. It is a kind of basic test.
Yeah, okay.
And indeed, you can get a kit from the chemist to check them. Though, you know, I discovered I was diabetic, and I didn't have a clue. My dad had it, so I should have been warned. I was 55, not that old, and yet I went to my GP for a completely different reason, had bloods taken, and she said, sorry. We had further tests. She said, sorry, you're going to have to start on drugs. And that's kind of what kicked me off. But I had not a clue. I had no symptoms, nothing at all.
Can I ask, did your doctor suggest a lifestyle change?
No.
No.
They almost never do. In theory, they do. My wife is a GP. She now puts all this stuff into practice. Indeed, she's doing a trial at the moment with Professor Susan Jebb at Oxford University, who is doing further work with pre-diabetics and diabetics.
Okay.
So they're doing a big collaboration together. And she said it's just astonishing.
Why don't
completely unaware of this?
Why don't GPs do it? Why don't GPs suggest to people who are diagnosed with type 2 diabetes that they should change their lifestyle and go on a diet?
Because until recently, the widespread belief, in fact, almost omniscient belief, was that diabetes is a progressive disease. There's nothing you can do about it.
Right.
You might as well start on the medication as soon as possible. Within 3 to 5 years, you'll probably progress to insulin, but that's tough.
Okay.
So a lot of doctors still believe that this is simply... And Roy Taylor, when he originally set out, everybody said to him... He was one of Europe's foremost diabetes specialists, but they all said to him, patients won't do it, they won't stick to it, and it won't last.
Right.
So this is a genuine revolution, you know, because this is a chronic disease in Ireland, in the UK, everywhere, massively on the rise. And you can do something about it. And that's, I guess, why, as I said, when I wrote the blood sugar diet... it's been in the bestseller list here in the UK for the last 3 years because people did it and it, you know,
it really worked. The Fast 800 is your new book. I want to get your opinion on yesterday's Lancet report where they...
On meat, yes.
And this is to save the planet and to save ourselves.
Yeah. So they suggest a surprisingly small amount. I think it worked out... I can't even remember how...
No, they're saying...
What is 50 grams for a week or something?
They're saying a burger a week and a steak a month. And then they're saying if you're on chicken, the equivalent of a nugget and a half...
No, I looked into it, I must admit. I mean, there were various concerns about some of the people involved because they have commercial interests, I believe. Anyway, I was surprised because I did a Horizon in which I went and talked across a broad spectrum of experts. These were mainly people who are quite committed to the vegetarian lifestyle. And I understand vegetarianism, I understand the moral and other, but I'm not convinced by their figures because when I looked into it, the magic figure, if you like, was around 50 grams of red meat a day on average. And that was similar, up to 100 grams seemed to be what was good for the planet. I did a two-parter where we looked at what's good for you and what's good for the planet, and broadly it came down to that. I mean, the biggest problem with meat, indeed, food production, is that about 50% of it is wasted.
Mm.
So if we could cut down on the waste, it's like energy, if we could increase efficiency, which is kind of happening... It would be one way around it. I mean, I applaud their desire to move us in a vegetarian, vegan direction. I am dubious about their numbers, and I think it's wildly unlikely the world is going to convert that fast.
Is that a problem with a lot of studies? You know, I'm not saying this one in particular, but you know, the people involved and who's funding it, and is that a, do you have to constantly check that when you're reading?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, clearly, and you know, when I'm talking here, you have to know that I'm telling you stuff and I've written a book and I'm going to make some money out of the book.
Yes, yes, yes.
So I'm not entirely neutral on this. I do try to give you the science from both sides of it. But clearly, everybody has their sort of
agenda,
spin and their thing to say, and that's kind of what makes it tricky.
It's so confusing then for people listening.
I feel a bit guilty, but I've kind of slightly sort of been rude about them, and that's not fair because there were lots of decent scientists there. But I know, you know, I know some of these studies forwards and backwards, and I was surprised. And indeed, other experts I've spoken to were surprised, not with the desire to have less, you know, meat being produced, but with the sort of numbers they came up with.
They didn't separate, well, maybe they did in the wider report. I only read the newspaper reports. They didn't separate between the individual and the planet. You know,
no, I mean, the two are, I guess, they were reflections of each other. So as I said, when I did The Horizon about meat, we actually did a two-parter. One of them was about how much red meat. And actually, The Horizon, we concluded, first of all, that, you know, when it comes to chicken and things like that, you're not that worried. It was just the kind of red meat. And then we actually boiled down to, in fact, red meat is not that important. The really important stuff for your health, as in a bad stuff for your health, is the processed stuff.
Right.
It's more
okay.
The sort of bacon and salami and things like that. And it's probably not to do with saturated fat. It's probably more to do with the nitrates and salt and the other preservatives.
Yes, yeah.
So we actually concluded that a modest amount of red meat contains lots of iron, vitamin B12 and things like that, is the evidence, you know, that it does bad things to your heart or indeed to your bowel cancer is minimal. I mean, in the figures I looked at and the studies I looked at, it either didn't exist or it raised the risk by about 10%. Now, if you smoke, that raises the risk by around 200%. So you get a relative sense. And
you can understand.
Professor David Spiegelhalter, who's a professor of statistics at Cambridge, he calculated that if you eat, every burger you eat knocks about 20 minutes of your life. So
every
whether you see that as a good thing or a bad thing.
Every burger you eat, right?
But if you go for a run, that's equivalent to watching about an hour of television.
Right.
But if you go for a run, then they'll stick 40 minutes on your life. So if you have the burger and go for the run, you might counter it out.
Right. The Fast 800 is the new book from Dr. Michael Mosley. I know you have a plane to catch, so thanks so much for taking our call today, Michael.
Pleasure. Lovely
enjoy
to speak
your holiday.
To you again.
Good to talk to you. Bye
and
now.
I was just going to say, if anyone wants to know more about who should and shouldn't do it as well, do visit the website, which is thefast800.com.
Great. Thanks, Michael.
Okay.
Bye now. Bye.
Bye.
Just about time to go. The best reason for stopping meat production is the gross cruelty involved, including live export and the terrible impact on wildlife of that person. And I saw Michael's doc. I am down 2.5 stone. I feel amazing. I eat one small meal at 3 o'clock and a main meal at 6. A whole food, veggie. So happy. Please thank Michael. That's Josie in Wexford. Well, he's gone, but I think we'll pass it on to him the next time we speak to him. That's it from us on the radio. Tomorrow night on the TV, we've Noel Edmonds of House Party, Top of the Pops, all that. We're going to have the 5 leaders from Operation Transformation, and they always get dressed up and they're always good fun when they come on the telly. And Kate Grant, a 20-year-old model from Tyrone, who was chosen as an ambassador for global cosmetics giant Benefit. She's on to tell her story as well. That's tomorrow after the news. Katie Hannon is up after, now on Drive Time, and we're back on the radio 3 o'clock on Monday. Good luck. Enjoy your weekend. The Ray Darcy.